Facebook's decision to block sites, block news sites here has made the international headlines as media companies and regulators around the world watch how brinkmanship between Australia's government and the tech giant plays out. Government information, private sites, emergency services pages, health sites were swept up in the band. And also Facebook says that it was done inadvertently. And while many of those pages have since been restored, there's widespread anger at Facebook's approach. The ban could have a significant international flow-on as regulators in some European countries also push for tech giants to pay for news content. Well, now let's talk to Siva Vaidyanathan. He's the author of the book Antisocial Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. He's also a media studies professor at the University of Virginia. Siva, welcome to RN Breakfast.
Thank you. It's very nice to be part of this conversation.
Great to chat to you. Now, Facebook has long warned they would block Australians from accessing news. You're a long-time Facebook watcher. Were you shocked when they decided to go through with this threat in relation to this legislation here in Australia?
I mean, Facebook has given sufficient warning that it would take some sort of action if this proposal continued. I think the timing was not predictable, and it comes on the same day that Google, its big rival for online attention and advertising, decided to make deals, right? Decided to actually negotiate with the Rupert Murdoch's properties, to negotiate with other news outlets in Australia, which was the ultimate goal of this legislation. So Facebook is out there on its own, seeming petulant, seeming incompetent, right? Because it ended up not actually capable of defining news sites anyway. And, you know, I find it all amusing at this point, amusing more than disturbing.
Okay, so you said it showed that they were incompetent. Is that something to do with their algorithm? Is it a little unsophisticated that it can't tell the difference between the Bureau of Meteorology and abc.net.au?
Well, part of the problem is that human communication and language is imprecise, right? So what is news to one person is not necessarily news to another. But yes, a significant portion of the problem and of Facebook's incompetence is its unsubtlety, its inability to do anything but at the highest algorithmic level. And so it's going to have false positives and false negatives whenever it filters anything. So to execute some sort of policy change on the world or even on Australia always yields these sorts of almost comical results. I mean, some of the results might not be comical. If there had been a weather emergency in Australia, which of course we've known there to be in recent years, it might have been a terrible day to have people unable to use Facebook to communicate with each other and link to the meteorological site. But let's remember, the web is bigger than Facebook. The world is much bigger than Facebook. So one thing that Facebook seems to be demonstrating is that while it has tremendous soft power, its power is given to it by us. If users in Australia, if citizens of Australia decide that they are perfectly happy engaging with news and information outside of Facebook, you know, Australia might be better off. After all, it won't be subject to the whims of Facebook's algorithms.
Siva, you mentioned a lack of subtlety in its algorithms. Is there a lack of subtlety in its leadership? And is that why it failed to negotiate in the same way that Google negotiated with the Australian government?
So I wrote a book about Google 10 years ago and a book about Facebook 3 years ago. And I've been thinking a lot about this, about the different styles of leadership and the different levels of maturity in the companies. I see Google run by a gentleman named Sundar Pichai, who is not idealistic in the least. He doesn't make business decisions based on what he considers higher principle. He makes business decisions based on what is best for Google and its investors, whereas Mark Zuckerberg, the only investor who matters in Facebook, makes decisions based on his own ideology. And his ideology basically says straight up that whatever is good for Facebook is good for the world. Now, the rest of us might not see that that equation quite so simply. But this is what Mark Zuckerberg carries with him, that anything that messes with Facebook or disturbs the way that Facebook has done business since the beginning is to be attacked, is to be criticized, is to be resisted. And so this petulance by one of the world's five wealthiest companies is unseemly, right? They're acting like Uber. When Uber faced any sort of regulation or any sort of requirements that they take driver safety seriously or driver background checks seriously in a particular country, or that they not undercut the prices of the incumbent industries, Uber would always pull out of a market and create a vacuum and urge Uber subscribers to complain to the government. You know, this seems like a very childish Uber-like reaction. You know, and I'm not convinced that the people of Australia are going to rise up in support of Facebook. I suspect that the people of Australia will remind themselves that they have been consuming quality news in various forms for many decades, and they did it before Facebook, and they might not need Facebook.
On RN Breakfast, it's 6 minutes to seven, and we're talking to Siva Vaidyanathan, author of the book Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. Siva, what about the international implications of this? Are other countries watching Australia's, fight going on here with Facebook, and are they learning things? Are they thinking themselves about whether there is a way of monetizing, a company that doesn't pay much tax globally, let's face it, and then re-diverting that money into public interest journalism?
That's right. There is a lot of attention, specifically in Canada and in the European Union, where there have been similar proposals. In the European Union, for a number of years, the regulators there have been invoking the sort of a stronger version of copyright than we're used to in North America, and even stronger than you're used to in Australia, to justify some sort of negotiation between commercial content providers of all kinds, not just news, and these big harvesters who tend to free ride on the work of others, Google and Facebook. Now, so those, you know, those laws and regulations and court cases come and go. I think people in Europe are looking at what happens in Australia, and they're going to see if this this proposal, which is an urge to negotiate, right? It's an effort to get these big companies, whether it's Rupert Murdoch's properties or any other media company, to negotiate with Facebook and Google on terms. If that is a decent model, if that actually provides some sort of revenue flow that didn't exist before and also provides access for citizens, you know, that could be a proof of concept. I think it's limited, though, right now to the European Union and Canada. Here in the United States, there is no appetite for any such intervention in these sorts of market relations. I wish there were, but I would prefer countries around the world to take more seriously the potential of taxing the data that Facebook and Google hoover up as a raw material that creates pollution, right?
Okay, let's talk more about that. Because, you know, there's one model debated in Australia at the moment, and the legislation has just passed the House of Reps. France has a model that they've negotiated with Google that will see them pay $98 million over 3 years to 121 French news publishers. So it seems at the moment broader than it is in Australia. What's your idea here in relation to data and monetizing that for governments?
Well, it's certainly an inchoate idea, but the notion is that, you know, many governments around the world force polluters to pay some sort of tax or fee based on the externalities that they create, whether it's, you know, carbon pollution or soot or you know, any other sort of pollution. And, you know, we tax tobacco, for instance, in much of the world because of the expensive public cost that results from the use of this product. Well, we can now look at Facebook and Google and say there is significant damage done to the public by the fact that they have been able to hoard so much of our attention and so much revenue, and they have so much cultural power and political power. So given that, what is the material to be taxed? Well, the fact that we are doing all this work, not just in the creation of content, but also in the production of data and metadata that these companies use to be able to target both advertisements and straight up content to us, that says to me that this is the soft spot. The only way to reduce the power of this business practice is to tax it heavily. Now,
maybe you can have a misinformation tax.
Well, the problem is defining misinformation, but it works out to be the same way, because it's not just about misinformation, right? Misinformation is not the only externality here. It's one of a series, including surveillance in and of itself, including the coercive nature of advertising. It includes the damage that is done through targeted political advertising. There are any number of ways that Facebook and Google harm the public that go beyond misinformation.
Yeah.
But, you know, any direct attack on misinformation also basically violates free speech, which is a problem in many of the world's largest economies.
Siva, we'll have to leave it there. Great to talk to you this morning. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Siva Vaidyanathan, author of the book Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. He's also a media studies professor at the University of Virginia.